coming up on Philosophy Talk.
It's the examined year, 2014.
A philosophical look at the year that was.
The year in race and justice.
Look at Ferguson. Young people feel despair. It's the older folks who are saying, be patient. There's a way to deal with this peacefully. And the younger folks don't want to hear it, right?
The year in academic freedom.
At bottom, I think this decision was an enormous insult to the students at the University of Illinois, as much as it is a larger problem for the First Amendment.
The year in neuroscience and the brain.
Within the limits of our nervous system, we create a universe that we experience through our brain projected onto the mind. To think we're coming even close to understanding all there is would be a joke.
What happened in 2014 that made us question our assumptions, think about things in new ways?
2014, the examined year.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our program comes to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We continue conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. Ken's a philosophy professor at Stanford, and I was for 40 years.
Today, it's a special edition of Philosophy Talk. The examined year, 2014, a look back at the philosophically compelling events and ideas that shaped the last 12 months, for better or for worse.
2014 was a year of fraught relations between law enforcement and African Americans. Fatal killings of unarmed black men by white police officers first led to massive protests around the country. And then the failure of grand juries to indict the officers in two high-profile cases set off even more protests.
To talk about the fraught year in race and justice, we'll be joined by Chris LeBron from Yale University. He's a professor of philosophy and of African American studies, and he's author of The Color of Our Shame, Race and Justice in Our Time.
On a lighter note, 2014 was designated by the European Brain Council as the Year of the Brain. We'll talk about the year in neuroscience with someone on the front lines of neuroscientific research, Rudy Tanzi, professor of neurology at Harvard University.
And in our own ivy-covered towers, 2014 was the year the University of Illinois unhired a new professor, a tenured professor, over his tweets about last summer's war in Gaza.
This led to lots of anguished discussion about the mission of universities and the nature of free speech on campus. We'll be joined in just a bit by Catherine Franke from the Columbia Law School to talk about the year in academic freedom.
Let's start that discussion off with our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari. She files this report.
2014, the year of disinviting college commencement speakers, like Condoleezza Rice at Rutgers and Michael Bloomberg at Harvard, and even Bill Maher. UC Berkeley students tried to boot him after he made incendiary comments about Islam.
And they invited me because it was the 50th anniversary of something that is legendary on that campus, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement. I guess they don't teach irony in college anymore.
There's also academic freedom a la Twitter. Professor Steven Salida left his job at Virginia Tech for tenure at University of Illinois. Then he posted some heated tweets when Israel was bombarding Palestine.
As the body count in Gaza rose over the past few weeks, the emotion in Steven Salida's tweets grew even more charged, like this one sent out on July 19th. At this point, if Netanyahu appeared on TV with a necklace made from the teeth of Palestinian children, would anyone be surprised?
Salida was accused of anti-Semitism and immediately lost his position at the University of Illinois.
It's the most egregious violation of a people's rights that I can imagine.
That's David Palumbo Liu. He's a Stanford professor and a very vocal supporter of Steven Salida.
Academic freedom is not just about being fired, although in Steven's case it was. It's also a matter of restricting your research. It's also a matter of just restricting your speech.
Palumbo Liu says academic freedom is about advancing knowledge through the debate of ideas. When that debate is stifled, it opens the door to academic repression. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
We're joined now by Catherine Franke, professor of law at Columbia University, director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Catherine, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you so much.
Catherine, Academic appointments, people may not know this, but academic appointments are the result of a long and very rigorous process. It takes letters of recommendations, committees, oversight, all kinds of stuff. And it seems like the University of Illinois just dismissed Stephen Salida without any due process or procedure because his tweets of all things, upset some influential donors. Now, how accurate is that picture?
Well, I think there are a number of things at stake here, though you've certainly put your finger on some of it. And it's not, these appointments are not just time-consuming. The issue here isn't just that people in the department committed a lot of time to this search that produced Professor Salida as their choice. There's a rigor of experts who are scholars in the field that put out an announcement for a new appointment, and people apply for it, and they come in, and they give talks, and their scholarship is reviewed. Letters are written by other scholars in the field testifying to the strength of their work. And at the end of that rigorous academic process, the American Indian Studies program produced Professor Salida as their choice for a new appointment in that department. And the Board of Trustees didn't just withdraw the appointment, they affirmatively rejected it. Having not read his work, having not reviewed any of his teaching evaluations, all they did was respond to what was an outcry by a very well-organized set of outsiders who did an end run around a process, an academic process that had integrity to it.
I'm assuming the scholarship is first rate.
The scholarship is first rate, but I will note that the scholarship is controversial. He has taken very controversial positions about the Israeli government as a colonizing, racist state entity, which is a controversial position, but particularly interesting one to be arguing from the position of American Indian Studies and thinking about settler colonialism and its partner racism in the modern state project. And he defends those ideas in a rigorous way in his work, and he offered ideas about those concepts in his tweets in a more colorful way, but they're not unrelated to his scholarship.
The disturbing pattern, I see that. Well, like, for example, when Angela Davis was fired from UCLA, and then she was reinstated for a year, but it resulted in the censure of the University of California for a long time by the American Association of University Professors. That was a clear, traditional, red-baiting, communist party thing. But now universities kind of live by the large donation, and they're seeing that there's some danger in that. This is a whole new source of pressure. Well, not a whole new source of pressure, but a new worrisome source of pressure where you have take so much money from groups, and then can you just ignore their wishes when it comes to appointments?
Well, I think it raises an interesting question of the evolution of the university, whether it's a public university or a private one like where I work, of universities becoming more like corporations. And their executives, whether it's the president or the chancellor, but whoever is the head of the university, sees him or herself as more responsible to donors and investors than to the constituency on campus, who by their very nature are involved in academic projects that may not gain any kind of wealth for the university and may actually be counter to the larger development goals of the university because the ideas may be controversial. But that's what we do in a university is test ideas, whether they're comfortable or uncomfortable.
I agree with you. And actually now that you say the way you put that, it troubles me deeply. And maybe I am wrong to have not been deeply troubled by it all these years. When I first came into the academy as a young man so long ago, I had senior colleagues who were then old, right? But they were of an age that they had lived through as young assistant professors and whatnot, part of the McCarthy era. They had memories of that era. And it sounded like an utterly terrible time to be an academic who was at all edgy or anything like that. I guess if you were a physics professor, but if you were a philosophy professor or Marxist leanings, you know, whatever, it's Marcuse and all that sort of stuff, it was frightening. And it sounds to me that there's a danger not of a kind of new McCarthyism not coming from the government, but coming from the funding sector that says, look, we don't want these things and we want those things. And I mean, how can
that's exactly right. And, you know, many of the students at the University of Illinois have voiced enormous frustration that their interest in having a diversity of ideas on campus in the classroom and in the research that the faculty are doing has been insulted by the chancellor stepping in and deciding, and the board of trustees deciding that they are too vulnerable to hear Professor Salaita's ideas. And at bottom, I think this decision was an enormous insult to the students at the University of Illinois, as much as it is a larger problem for the First Amendment.
Yeah, you know, see, so this is a deep question I wondered about this, because I was reading about some of this stuff that happened at Berkeley and a student letter of protest saying that the university had the obligation to protect students from speech that is marginalizing and demeaning. And I can understand that to a certain extent. But I got to confess, I'm kind of a million about this, that full freedom of expression is instrumental to the search for truth, the collective search for truth. So false opinions, unpopular opinion, it deserves as much protection as any other opinion, as true opinion. But on the other hand, there is this argument that certain speech does more than just express attitudes. Certain speech actually demeans or marginalizes. It doesn't just express my view that such and such, you know, but if it's backed, especially by the university, the power of the university, the power of the institution, it actually achieves an effect in the world of marginalizing certain students or certain points of view or certain groups. And the university shouldn't be an instrument of marginalization. What do you think about that kind of argument?
Well, I think students experience themselves as marginalized or as empowered from a whole range of the ideas that we encounter in the university setting. And what counts as a true idea or a false idea or one that marginalizes or enfranchises shifts over time. So, for instance, we have a lot of vets at Columbia, both in the university but also in the law school. And if we have faculty who are writing scholarship or teaching critically of the national security state and the militarization of our foreign policy, those students may feel marginalized. But I don't think that we would say that we can't voice those views in the university. They might be controversial, or those in a more left university, like you folks out on the West Coast, perhaps, where the left students might feel marginalized by a more conservative faculty member who's teaching a class justifying the security state and the militarization of our foreign policy. What we're training students to do is to be full members of society and to be able to make arguments in a way as citizens. And to protect them from ideas that they find injurious or somehow uncomfortable does them a disservice, and it certainly diminishes the idea of the university.
Well, I mean, my own view is I see a big difference between a student standing, say, up over by our Trester Union in the free speech area with a sign that says, I don't think Afro-Americans should be admitted to the university and would prefer on balance that they go home. I think that's going to make a lot of people feel bad, but that's the guy's right if he wants to stand there. But if he stands there and shouts, go home, and then the N-word, that's different. The university has every right to say you can't do that. It's a hard line to draw, but I think it's an important one because I don't think the First Amendment gives people the right to shout insults and slurs, but it gives them the right to hold the opinions that might lead them to that.
That's right. And, you know, there is plenty of racism, sexism. You know, we've all been talking about sexual assault in the campus context and in my university and across the country. There's certainly anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in all of our campuses. And to say that we need a robust notion of free speech and academic freedom in the university context is not to deny that we experience bigotry and all manner of bigotry on our campuses as well. And to say that we could have a bright line rule is naive, if not ignorant, I think, of the complexity of these problems. But we need to have a much thicker conversation about the difference between critical speech that makes us uncomfortable and challenges settled ideas of what's right or what's true and hate speech on the other side. And I don't think there's any question that Professor Salaita's speech and the speech of these students and the research proposals of other faculty who've been punished for submitting those proposals fall so far away from the line of hate speech as opposed to uncomfortable speech.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been a fascinating conversation. It's a deep topic. We've only scratched the surface. Maybe someday we'll do a whole episode and we can have you back and we can talk for an hour about it.
That'd be great. Thank you so much.
Catherine Franke from Columbia University on the year in academic freedom.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're looking through a philosophical lens at the ideas and events that shaped the last 12 months. It's the examine year 2014.
2014 may be remembered most for the breakdown of trust between police and the people they serve and protect. From the fatal shootings of unarmed black men by white police officers, to grand juries that failed to indict cops, to the military-style response to the protests that followed, it was quite a year.
It's the year in race and justice, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Looking back at 2014 here on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look back at some of the events and ideas of 2014. Events and ideas that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
We turn now to the year in race and justice. Beginning with a dispatch from the front lines by our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari.
You want to know how many people are shot by police officers each year? Me too. There's no reliable national data available. We do know that in 2014, over 24 unarmed people of color were killed by police officers.
My name is Oscar.
Mackenzie Cochran, age 25, killed while being restrained by mall security guards in Southfield, Michigan. Yvette Smith, age 47, shot and killed on her front porch in Bastrop, Texas. Victor White, age 22, Liberia Parish, Louisiana. They say Victor shot himself, handcuffed in the back of a police car.
Fruitvale.
Eric Garner, 43, Staten Island, New York. Eric tells police officers, "I can't breathe," 11 times before he dies from a chokehold.
Put your hand behind your back right now. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
Romaine Brisbane, 34, Phoenix, Arizona. Killed after a police officer mistook his bottle of pills for a gun. Tamir Rice, 12 years old. Shot and killed in Cleveland, Ohio, for carrying a BB gun.
Apology.
Michael Brown, 18, killed in Ferguson, Missouri, for stealing cigarettes. John Crawford, 22. Dante Parker, 36. Hajimi Powell, 25. Akai Gurley, 28.
I am you.
2014, the year that highlighted the number of unarmed people of color killed by cops. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Joining us now is Christopher LeBron. He's a professor of African American Studies and Philosophy at Yale University. He's also author of The Color of Our Shame, Race and Justice in Our Time. Chris, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for having me, Ken and John.
Chris, some of the things that happened last year bring to mind past events, like the murder of Emmett Till in 1955. At the time, that had a galvanizing force on the civil rights movement. Do you think the events of this year are potentially that galvanizing?
They might be as galvanizing if they were exceptional. I think the one thing that has maybe changed a bit this year has been increased coverage and pickup of these kind of stories. I mean, one thing that is important to keep in mind, at least in the United States, is that it is not as if Trayvon Martin or Oscar Grant or Jordan Davis or Eric Garner or Michael Brown, these aren't kind of exceptional occurrences in the past year or two or past 3 years. This has been a regular fact of black life in America since slavery.
Yeah.
I think what might be changing is, on the one hand, I think technology is making it easier not only to report this, but what's really striking is the increasing number of videos that are captured of these offenses. Part of it has to do with technology being installed in the institutions of police. And so in some sense, they're implicating themselves in these activities. And sometimes they're caught by bystanders. I mean, the Rodney King thing was quite exceptional when that took place. That was not yet a norm, but now now everyone has a technology in their pocket. So I think what is happening is that these events are getting our attention much more frequently, and also much, in some senses, much quicker. And that being the case, I think that tends to stoke the perception that it's galvanizing. But I mean, if every time we find out about these kind of events, people are incensed, I think the rash of them over the past 3 years, I think has intensified people's perceptions and feelings about it. So I think that part has changed, and I think that is pushing us, I think, to a situation which we're going to have to think about resolution and change.
So look, I want to think about the, let's call it the mutual cognition of these events, because they're now, in a way that they weren't before, out in the public because of all this technology that you were talking about. I want to think about what these events show us about, teach us or show us about how we have been perceiving race or have not been perceiving race. Because one of the things a lot of people believe, we're in a new age. We're in a kind of post-racial age. And if you live in California where I live, I mean, kids growing up, think of them here in California, they don't quite think of themselves as beyond race, but they think people like of my generation, especially, and older. I mean, there are still people older than me, but I'm getting to be one of the older folks. People of my generation who grew up obsessed with civil rights and affirmative action and all that, we're just hung up on this thing, and it's not such a deep reality anymore. Do you think I got that right about how many Americans perceive race? And then what does all these events breaking out in the public view do to that perception of race? Does it challenge it, confirm it? What?
So no, these are really good points, Ken. So the first part of what you said, I think you are right in perceiving that there's a large proportion of Americans who think we've moved beyond race in important ways. I mean, there was no shortage of commentary after Obama was elected saying, "See, there we go. Conversation over. Right? All people have been complaining about racial inequality. We have a black man as president, so we can move on." But we also note that there is a number of people who, for them, this is just confirmation of what they thought all the time, that blacks in some sense should be the targets of police. And I think there is a difficult point that we're moving towards, because I think when we speak about 1963, right, in some sense, everyone knew the score. Racism explicitly was a much more widespread thing. And many people knew where everyone stood. But now we're in, decades after the Civil Rights Act, and we have formal equality. So now what that has done, in some sense, has denied or at least made it difficult for people to make claims based on institutional racism, because people go, well, look, that's not the law of the land anymore. And most people are not explicit racist. And so the question is, how to address the persistence and people's perception, the moral cognition of this problem in the face of something they think, right, should not exist, because it's an unreasonable thing, right? Racism is irrational.
One interesting thing is that black people and police, and there is a transformation of police departments, or maybe two transformations of police departments going on. One is a militarization of them, driven by cheap equipment coming back from our various wars. The other is this so-called community policing, which on the whole sounds like a good thing. There's a big push in Oakland right now. It's traditionally a hard area in terms of crime and in terms of aggressive police work to have community policing. So is part of the problem not simply bias against black, but also an incorrect conception of what police departments should be?
So I think there's definitely something to that, but there's an important point to keep in mind. Prior to the success of the civil rights movement, and success in a qualified sense, the country didn't seem especially interested in the question of policing. But 64, we get the Civil Rights Act, and beginning almost right then, the criminal justice system begins to grow, partially as a response to riots that were happening, and partially as a response, a counter-rights response, right? White Americans thought they had a right to peaceful neighborhoods and freedom from, you know, protest and the kind of disruptions those brought. So we have a legacy in this country that begins with the Civil Rights Act, where we get the idea of funding to surveil, funding to suppress, funding to incarcerate and to capture. And so you're absolutely right that
so
in
Chris,
some sense
there's... Chris, let's break it. Let's take it. Okay, I get the history. I get the complicated social dynamics. I want to do some philosophy here. Because think about what you said. You said in passing, we've achieved formal equality. That is, the law no longer allows us to make invidious distinctions between people on the basis of their race, or to treat them differently merely because, or to denigrate some and promote others merely because of their race. And we've had a tough struggle with kind of getting to this point, because that involves not just oppression, but, you know, white people were worried about reverse discrimination, and there's a tough struggle to get to what should the law allow. We've got some kind of modus vivendi in terms of the formal requirements of law to treat people equally and to ignore race, right? But I think all these events show that, let's call it equal respect, not under the law, but just in our own ethos, in our own ethos. Equal respect is not like built into our shared political ethos, and maybe we need to address that more rather than, you know, formal equality. And maybe your way of thinking about this stuff helps us to see that. What do you think?
So I think you're right about that. So this is one of the things that my work has really been trying to focus on, is trying to figure out how we do political philosophy, taking very seriously, not merely in an abstract sense, what is wrong about disrespecting someone, but what does disrespecting someone do to that person, right? One of the things we want to try to figure out. So let's just take our vocabulary in political thought. We think about things like fairness, equality, reciprocity, justifiability, legitimacy. But here's another vocabulary that political philosophy, especially when it comes to race, we are maybe a bit wary of and rarely see: hope, despair, anguish, fear, anxiety, terror, right? So when we broaden our moral vocabulary to include these kinds of concepts, this is when you begin to think in a deeper, maybe less systematic fashion, because these concepts are, I don't think they're as susceptible to the kind of neat analysis that analytic philosophers prefer. And so this is the kind of thing I've been trying to think about.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the Examine Year 2014. We're talking with Chris LeBron from Yale University about the year in race and justice.
So, Chris, supposedly, hypothetically, made you kind of czar of everything having to do with race relations for a couple of days. What are the two or three big things, if you could just change them with a stroke of a pen, you would change?
So one thing I would most certainly do is underwrite a very kind of radical epistemic ground for our educational system. I mean, coming up when I was going to school, I learned a few basic things about race as a young person. Lincoln freed slaves, Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream, and then everything was okay. This is essentially what I learned So didn't learn about Malcolm X, didn't learn about the Panthers, the fact that they were the Black Panther Party for self-defense. Well, why would an American community need a party for self-defense, right? Why would anyone need that? That's an important question for a young person to ask. It's a scary question, but one that gives persons a grounds to assess, right, their institutions, as Rawls would want us to do. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing I would do is actually, and of course, conservatives and tea parties would go mad about this, but one of the things I affirm in my book is a participatory principle of justice, and that is that the government to subsidize widespread oversight committees at a very local and low levels, especially in communities that are over-policed, economically disadvantaged, to oversee the institutions that have outsized impacts on their neighborhood. One of the things that's a fact of American democratic life is that the absence of resources is in some sense tantamount to an absence of influence and power. And the government can do something about that in terms of equalizing both access to power, but also the deployment of it. And the people who need to be able to deploy power in this country are those who over whom power seems to be wielded arbitrarily. And if we could reverse that access, I think that would be a very great improvement.
But it strikes me, you know, I lived through the 60s. And you mentioned Malcolm X, and there were people who thought Black people needed not just the vote, they needed revolution or something. They needed armed insurrection or something. That way of thinking That has a deep strand in American history, in African American history, a deep strand. But it seems to have gone away. There seems to be, and it often puzzles me why it went away, that there is not really a revolutionary consciousness in the African American community. There's not even a hint of a revolutionary consciousness. And I wonder why is not there not?
So I think one might think that because there is an ascendant upper class of black folks, I think you see both some class and also generational divisions, right? I mean, look at Ferguson. Young people feel despair. It's the older folks who are saying, be patient. There's a way to deal with this peacefully. And the younger folks don't want to hear it, right? But that division in some sense, right, saps some of the energy out of a more concerted expression of rage, which these people rightfully feel. But also, I mean, communities learn historical lessons. And one thing that the Panthers taught the black community is it's okay for some Americans to publicly display guns, just not you. It's okay for some Americans to claim the right to arms for self-defense, just not you. And believe me, if I was president, the third thing I would do is get rid of every gun in this country. I abhor the things. But to the extent that this country seems to be unable to shake its love affirmation for the Second Amendment and what that entails for ordinary Americans, blacks have been taught in this country that the very basic idea of self-defense, right? Not equal rights, not inclusion, not fairness, that the very idea of self-defense does not apply to them. It is not within domain of the things that they can expect to demand. And so that historical lesson is a very debilitating historical lesson. So they have to, in some sense, reconstitute their various complaints in these other ways that are far from revolutionary. So I think I would say that those are two things that explain the loss of revolutionary consciousness, even though I'm sure we could think of some other things given some time.
Yeah, it's a complicated stuff. This is really rich and complicated stuff. I sometimes despair of the possibility of true democracy in the United States.
I should point out that people like Malcolm X or Bobby Seale in today's world might well have been diverted into the prison system before they had a chance to get a revolutionary perspective out into the world.
I think that's probably right. So, you know, so along with Ken, I often feel despair as well, but I'll also keep on to the hope that with people out there thinking about these things and having forums like Philosophy Talk Radio, we could do a small part to keep the conversation going.
There you go, Chris. Thank you so much for lending us your insight on this tough
stuff. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Chris LeBron from Yale University joining us to think about the year in race and justice. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year, 2014.
So, Ken, since our conversation with Chris, there have been two grand juries that have failed to indict the police officers involved, the police officer in Ferguson and the police officers involved in the strangling in Staten Island. So, do the deliberations of these grand juries suggest to you that maybe these guys weren't so guilty after all? Or what does it make you think?
Well, you know what? It makes me think a lot of things, but I know what it makes a lot of people think, that grave injustice has been done here and that our criminal justice system is badly, badly out of whack in ways that that disadvantage black people. And I share that outrage. Even my son, my high school son, who hasn't been all that politically active, is organizing a protest as part of his high school through downtown Los Altos. So I think it's a big deal. I hope and believe. Well, I more hope than believe that this will spark serious consciousness raising on the part of all people of goodwill. Because I think it was two grave miscarriages of justice.
Well, I've got one African American child and six African American grandchildren, Ken, and I despair for the future of African Americans in our blighted society.
Well, I despair for the future of us all. We don't want to live in a police state, and I think grand juries that let and prosecutors that don't ask hard questions of the police and don't hold them to high standards, I think there's a danger of our devolving into a police state.
This is Philosophy Talk. It's our annual philosophical year in review, the examined year 2014.
The European Brain Council declared 2014 the year of the brain. Over here in the U.S., there was some pretty mind-bending brain research going on, too. In our next segment, we'll talk to one of the main movers and shakers behind that research.
It's the year in neuroscience and the brain, when Philosophy Talk continues. Looking back at 2014 here on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look back at the past 12 months. Right now, the year in neuroscience and the brain.
Our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, has set both her mind and her brain on the subject, and she files this report.
Let's start big, like $46 million big. That's how much the National Institutes of Health poured into President Obama's BRAIN initiative. Here, the NIH director explains the initiative.
BRAIN stands for Brain Research Through Advancing Innovative Neurotechnologies. We are seriously tackling an understanding of the most complicated biological structure in the known universe.
Then there's Europe's Human Brain Project, a 10-year, $1.4 billion program to build a computer simulation of the human brain. This year, they scrapped cognitive sciences from the project. And that didn't go too well.
Hundreds of scientists have signed an open letter calling for Europe's massive human brain project to be re-evaluated and, if necessary, scrapped, and it set off a brainy brawl unfolding in the media.
Scientists in Oxford also created a blood test that can predict if someone will get Alzheimer's disease within a year. Across the pond in Massachusetts, they partially replicated the disease, creating an Alzheimer's brain.
A brain in a dish, if you will, a petri dish. They've developed a petri dish with human brain cells that produce the telltale structures of Alzheimer's disease.
The man who helped create this brain in a dish is our next guest on Philosophy Talk. Take it away, John Perry.
Thanks, Shuka. We're joined now by Rudolf Tanzi. He's professor of neurology at Harvard University and director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. Rudy, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Rudy, there was an important discovery in brain research this past year that I think was a culmination of work you've done. Is that right?
Yeah, we had a paper in the journal Nature that just came out, and for the first time recreated Alzheimer's disease in a dish, in a petri dish.
Wow.
Using a mini brain. So this is basically taking stem cells, turning those into human neurons, and introducing into them the mutations that cause Alzheimer's disease, the gene mutations. And then we were able to, for the first time, recreate Alzheimer's pathology in the dish. And what that told us was how the disease starts, because that's been a real controversy. There's this stuff in the brain called beta amyloid, and many of us have claimed that's what starts the disease, but it was always debatable. And we put that debate to rest. We showed that if these nerve cells in a dish make amyloid, this beta amyloid, this sticky material, then the rest of the pathology comes from that. And that really gives us basically a good angle now for new drug therapy.
So this is what used to be called in the old days of a philosophy of science, the crucial experiment, the experiment that decides yes or no on some question at issue. So there came a time in the philosophy of science, I think I've got this right, that philosophy of science says there's no such thing as the crucial experiment. But this sounds like this was the crucial experiment. Is that right?
I think of all the experiments I've done in my career, this one comes closest to a crucial experiment, because what we now know is that the amyloid that forms the plaques and then the tangles that choke the nerve cells from inside and kills them, both of these pathologies matter. But what this new experiment answered was what causes what. Mm-hmm. And what we could determine, the amyloid is causing the tangles. So both matter, but it's the amyloid that causes the tangles and then nerve cells die. But, you know, you can also get tangles without amyloid. Just play five seasons of NFL football with a lot of unfortunate helmet-to-helmet hits, and you'll also get tangles without needing amyloid.
So, Rudy, we're philosophers, and I'm interested in the mind. I'm also interested in the brain, but I'm interested in the brain because I'm interested in the mind. I think of Alzheimer's. I know there's some neural pathology going on, but, you know, Does that neural pathology that you've discovered, does it help us explain why the mind of Alzheimer's patients, you know, their memory deficits and their radical presentness, as it were, does it help us to understand why the mind appears to us the way it does in an Alzheimer's patient, why they seem to gradually lose what we think of as a sense of an enduring self and all that? Or
I think it does, because you can start with the pathology and look at where it accumulates and ask, what does that do to the brain? And simply speaking, what it does is it slowly eliminates your ability to take new information coming in, like you're hearing me speak right now, that's sensory information. But, you know, if I ask you what I said, you know, in another minute, you'll be able to say most of it or get the gist of it. But that's because you're storing what I'm saying in your short-term memory. And what we know is that where this pathology accumulates, the plaques and the tangles, affects the ability to take new information that you're learning and actually store it as short-term memory. And that's what gives you context in terms of time and space. So to have self, you need some continuity in time and space. Otherwise, you're just completely in the moment with sensory information, which is great, you know, if you're seeking a, you know, a Zen experience and meditation, but you want to be able to then recoil into self and enjoy it. You lose the latter in Alzheimer's disease.
Well, so now I'm getting my reductive scientistic side is, I'm being stirred by what you said, because now I'm thinking one of the grand ambitions of a certain kind of philosopher, other kind of philosophers say this isn't going to happen, but a certain kind of philosopher, a reductive philosopher that in most days I think of myself as, is to show how the mind, you know, as it were, the software, the consciousness, the thinking emerges from the brain, from all these neural transmitters and synaptic junctions, how the brain gives rise to the mind. And this is one of the cool things about, I think, neuroscience and what you guys do. Well, one of my colleagues once said to me, well, why? We were talking about a philosopher who studies pathology and broken brains. And she said, what's so interesting about broken brains? I said, well, because they're nature's experiments. And if we really want to understand the mind, what we really have to do is break it and see how breaking it here and breaking it there affects mentation. But human subjects committees, fortunately or unfortunately, well, fortunately for morality, unfortunately for the advancement of science, won't let you just go around breaking people's brains in systematic ways. But you guys, that's what you get. You get the broken brains and you figure out how exactly they're broken and what's the effect of their brokenness. So I think you guys are actually going to give us a way to peer into how the brain gives rise to the mind. That's what I find so exciting about your work.
I find it very exciting and couldn't imagine doing anything else. But I mean, let's take these two terms, information processing and broken, and then ask what's broken, the information or the processing? Now, when you think about what we've learned about the brain, and most of the studies, like I'm a neuroscience, you know, I have a doctorate in neurobiology, and so had to study basically a lot of neurophysiology. And what we've learned is how do neurons record information, categorize it, associate it, maintain it, and recall it. And you can recall it based on various associations. Anytime you learn, it's all learning is based on associating new things with what you already know. So we understand how neural networks do that, record, maintain, store, recall. But where is the information, right? So when I can picture my mother's face in my mind right now, where's the JPEG with the data of her face? How is that stored in the brain? Answer, we have no idea.
Right.
How do you store a feeling in the brain? How do I actually store a complex feeling in a neural network? I can understand how I recall the feeling, but how to store it, we still don't know. That's why I still lay open as a scientist a question of mind versus brain and who's generating who.
So it sounds to me like the problem with Alzheimer's is a little bit like you had a computer and, you know, all the files are intact, the keyboard works, the stuff appears on the screen, but you can't use the save button. And that would be an enormous thing to know about your computer, why it wasn't working. And it would suggest you might be able to fix it. But it really wouldn't disclose the miracle of computers, which I guess some people understand, although not me.
I think it's a good analogy. I mean, in Alzheimer's disease, just like you said, I mean, not only can you not save what's on the screen on the computer, but in full-blown Alzheimer's, what you write on the screen is disappearing as you type it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's even worse. And I have friends, you know, I mean, I meditate a lot, and you know, I have friends who meditate, and they say, wow, but that doesn't sound so bad. You're living in the moment. I'm like, yeah, but it's great to live in the moment if you know you're living in the moment. You have to, I mean, if there's no one to know you're living in the moment, then what's the point?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, the examined year 2014. We're talking about the year in neuroscience and the brain with Rudy Tanzi from Harvard University.
2014 was the year of the brain in Europe, right? They're mapping the brain the way the Human Genome Project mapped the human genome. You think that's a promising thing? It's going to yield great insight?
I think to compare the mapping of the brain to the mapping of the human genome is a stretch. You know, mapping the human genome, we didn't just map it. We sequenced the human genome. We came up with the code, the genetic code for who we are. And then we learned that it wasn't even enough, that gene activity based on how we live our lives, our perspective, our stress level, our diet matters as well. And what they're doing with the brain is just asking how it's connected. It's a connectome rather than a genome. They're asking how different brain regions are connected. Well, that's going to teach us, again, how neural networks interact with each other and record and recall and associate information. But will it teach us where the mind is? Will it teach us anything about consciousness? I doubt it.
So look, here's my closing thought about this. Okay, I think it's a really hard problem, but that is to reconcile what we know about the mind with what we're learning about the brain, to bring these together in one symphony that says, this is how these facts about the brain give rise or relate to these facts about the mind. I mean, I ultimately think it's a give rise, but I think you're illustrating that that's a hard problem. It's not just a problem in neuroscience. It's not just a problem that you can solve by, you know, burying your noses in the details of the brain. You gotta be able to do this thing, right, of somehow looking at the mind, looking at all you know about the brain, and then somehow bringing them together in a single picture. And the job for doing that, I think that's actually the job of scientifically informed philosophy. It's like philosophy and science together doing this thing. What do you think about that thought of mine?
Yeah. In fact, I had dinner 2 weeks ago with David Chalmers, who coined the term the hard problem. Fascinating guy. And we talked about what is the role of a scientist? What is the role of a neurophilosopher? And, you know, where do you find that common ground? And right now in science, as a neuroscientist, we can understand how the brain functions as a network of connections, memory traces, neurons firing to other neurons, turning them on, allowing you to record and recall information, to associate events of information. We can learn how when you're in deepest sleep, delta wave, slow wave sleep, that you consolidate short-term memories into long-term memories. That's why sleep is so important. But then when you get into the question of, well, what is consciousness? You know, how is the brain actually producing for you the entire world you live in and all of its nuances? How do you do that with fat, protein, and water and electricity? And that is, like you say, that is the hard problem. Can we ever get to it scientifically? And the problem is we're always going to be a brain that you can argue is a product of consciousness trying to understand consciousness. So will you ever be able to break out of that box? And I just don't know how to do it.
Well, you know, on that note of puzzlement, Rudy, I really have to thank you for joining us. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'd love to have you back for a whole hour sometime so we can really dig into some of these issues.
I'd love to come back. Just let me know.
Rudy Tanzi from Harvard University and his thoughts on the year in neuroscience in the brain.
We invite you to contribute your thoughts about the year that was at our online community of thinkers at Philosopher's Corner, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
You can become a partner in the community of thinkers at our website, philosophytalk.org. And if you've enjoyed the show, we need your support to continue producing thought-provoking programs like this one.
Please consider a donation. Help keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
Now a speed read through the ups and downs of 2014. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when I was a kid, I didn't pay much attention to New Year. It was kind of fun to stay up till midnight, but I was 10. I wasn't really a drinking man. My folks weren't party animals either. We didn't have noisemakers. Even if we did, we wouldn't have used them. I mean, for crying out loud, it was the dead of winter, middle of the night. People were trying to sleep. But I do remember magazines, Time, Life, Look, Newsweek, Saturday Evening Post, Saturday Review. My folks loved magazines. Magazines would always have a year in review feature, a look back at the most important people and events of the year, which struck me as odd because even as a kid, I knew that the magazines were the ones who made these people and events important in the first place. And now magazines have fallen by the wayside. You'd think the yearly predictions and tributes and log ruling would have gone away as well. Those were all top-down judgments about what was worth remembering into the upcoming year and what should be thrown into the dustbin of yesterday's news. But oddly, the culture has become even more top-down. The only difference is the top is us. We make the people and events famous and important, then we vote on them again and again. Some old mainstream media are still hanging in there. Time magazine just made the Ebola health workers their person of the year. Used to be man of the year, remember that? Used to be an actual person, remember that? New York Times just had a year-end feature showing the year's best actors in 9 kisses. See what they did there? They disrupted the traditional year-end best list by making it 9 instead of 10 and having them kiss, instead of just pouting at the camera the way movie stars used to do. You have to do something to set yourself apart from the pack, because everybody's got a list. The big one, of course, is now Google. The top 10 searches of the year. And what were they? Well, from number 1... Robin Williams, the World Cup, Ebola, Malaysia Airlines, Flappy Bird, ALS Ice Bucket Challenge, ISIS, Ferguson, Frozen, and Ukraine. What the hell is Flappy Bird is my first question. And where are Joan Rivers, Kale, Pharrell's hat, Kim Kardashian's butt, and Renee Zellweger's face? Well, don't worry, they're out there. There are lists everywhere. There are top 10 lists of top 10 lists and top lists of those. There are year-round lists. There are listicles. Stop making these sleep mistakes. Meet the 10 hottest young lesbians. Top 10 unreleased sex tapes, top 10 people you never heard of making duck faces, top 10 selfies, top 10 things that killed our attention spans, top 10 ways to get that list down to 7, 10 sexy ways to say what? Kittens, puppies, beheadings. We save old looks in Life magazines and put them in bags to sell at the antique mall. Well, the internet will never be old-timey. It's all there, brand new, all the time. Books were supposed to outlast us, but they're going to be replaced by the internet. The internet will be around long after we are gone, and our children and their children. People looking will fade, but the people looked at will never go away. Information used to exist for us. Then we throw the magazines away. We can't do that anymore. We are there to help information, not the other way around. We'll be dust. Information will still be there. And will information even care that we're gone? Yes. It will care about us in 10 important ways. Click here for more. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
The category, top 10 signs you're a dumb guy. Yes! Yes! At last! Something I'll understand.
Okay.